Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Carol J. McAmis. Professor McAmis is a graduate of the University of Kansas, where she studied piano and voice performance. Since 1992, she has been a professor of performance studies at Ithaca College, where her specialty is voice. She is an accredited teacher of the Feldenkrais method of somatic education, which she applies to both singers and performers. McAmis is also a performer herself and has appeared as a soprano soloist for the Ithaca College Chorus and the Ithaca College Orchestra. She's also had leading roles with the Ithaca Opera Association. And welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Now, tell us what it was that inspired you to go into the profession of music and voice and singing and so on.
Well, I'd have to say that's my mother. She loved opera singers. And when I was growing up back in the 1950s, there were all sorts of wonderful shows on television all the time. The Firestone Hour, Ed Sullivan had Roberta Peters, who's the former trustee of IC, on many, many, many times. And my mother just thought the greatest thing in the world was to sing high C. So I was always brainwashed. I started playing the piano very young, when I was 4 or 5. I'm not exactly sure how old I was, but it's been in my life forever. My focus was always mainly on piano. People started hearing me sing, like, for the fourth grade chorus audition, and the teacher's like, oh, this is a real voice. I'm like, that's nice. I like to sing. And it just kind of went along. I played the cello in high school and just have always been associated with music.
Just followed your musical bliss in some ways. Did you ever entertain the idea of becoming just a performer, or did you always think you'd go into teaching?
I did. Well, I always knew in the back of my mind that I wanted to teach, but I did for a while entertain that idea about being a performer, and people kept saying, Carol, it's not going to satisfy you. You like to do too many different things. And the doors sort of opened more in the direction of teaching, and I did indeed get really fascinated with it, and ended up going that route. And then being in a wonderful situation at the Ithaca College School of Music, we have fantastic faculty of wonderful performers, so you could just walk down the hall and say, who wants to sing the Brahms Liebeslieder waltzes with me? Let's do it, you know?
That's not everyday language that you hear.
No, it's not. But in my building where I work, people come out of the woodwork and say, oh, that's great. When shall we do it? You know? So it's been a wonderful opportunity to be an artist teacher in my career.
Yeah, and I noticed that you are both.
Yes.
In your quest for teaching people how to sing and how to use their voices, are you dealing mainly with people who are in their careers, or do you also teach beginners?
That's a good question. At Ithaca College, I pretty much deal with voice majors who are going to be some sort of professional musician. Not all of them are looking for opera careers. We have musical theater people. We have people who are interested in a cappella singing. You may be familiar with the Ithaca Pella men's group up there. We have a lot of guys who come through and do that. We have wonderful teachers who go out in the public schools. We have people who sing world music and use their voices in lots of different ways. So
you've got everybody coming.
Everybody comes in with some background that I work with these days. I do work occasionally privately with someone who's more of a beginner, but not so much anymore.
Do people who want to go into singing, like choruses or ensembles or something, do they know that they need training? Or is that something somebody has to tell somebody?
Well, it depends on the person and where they are. If they're comfortable and they're having a good time singing, if they're an amateur, then they're fine. You know, they can just enjoy their voice and not have a problem. But if they want to get serious about it, or if they start having a problem, then they come looking for a voice teacher to help them figure out how to be better with the coordination so they're not hurting themselves when they sing.
Now, you had said that your working definition of singing was exhale and vibrate with feeling.
Right.
Can you expound on that and tell us if you've thought of some other descriptive notes for that?
Oh, yes, sure. That's kind of the fundamental place that I come from, is just to remind myself that it's actually, although it's extremely complicated neuromuscular activity and probably one of the most complicated things human beings do to really train a voice. At the same time, it's wonderfully simple, and sometimes we can overthink it and get so caught up in what's my jaw doing and what does my word sound like? Is that really father, or am I saying father or something like that? You know, and you get really self-conscious about it. So I like to keep bringing my students back to the idea that we sing, we make sound on the exhalation, our throats vibrate at the larynx, our bodies vibrate, and we make sound, and we communicate with feeling. A quote that I really love, there are two of them. One is by Patricia Kaminsky, who's a flower essence practitioner, and she talks about the ability to ensoul sound with thought and feeling being one of the greatest of human gifts. I love that.
Yeah.
And then another thing that I ran across is that the Latin roots for the word person are personare, which means through sound. So that our voices, you know, artists in any field are always looking to find their voice, whether it's a writer's voice or a painter's voice in their artwork. And So a lot of them will come and actually study singing because they feel like if they can physically find their own voice, it's going to make a difference in their art form.
You know, one thing you pointed out in some of the materials you sent me was how the voice is an instrument, unlike a violin or a piano or a guitar, anything that's totally finished. And a voice is something that's in transition, that's always changing. Is that hard for singers to grasp?
Yes.
Because a lot of people think they're going to reach their peak and that's going to be where they're going to be, right?
Right. Or they think, this is the voice I was born with, I'm stuck with it, one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's absolutely not the case. It's more like athletic training where you continue to refine your coordination throughout your career. You can always improve. There's always something that you can be better about. I had the good fortune to hear Benita Valente at Cornell a number of years ago. Wonderful operatic soprano, 30-year career at the Met. And she did one concert, and then about 10 years later, she came back, and she sounded even better than she had the first time. And I asked her what was her secret, and she said, every day I learned something about singing I didn't know before.
Ah.
So that's always, I think, you know, this wonderful process. And then as a teacher, I get completely unique instruments. Every one of them is totally different way that they're going to approach their singing, the style they want to sing, how they think about singing, and I get to play with new instruments all the time. They're always, I tell them they're always throwing me for a loop somehow or other.
Yeah, so, an instrument with a brain.
Yes,
that's
exactly.
an interesting
and then
thought.
There's just simply the fact that you live in this instrument and you have to be, if you're going to be a really high-level professional, you have to be quite disciplined in terms of sleeping and eating and figuring out these crazy travel schedules. Now people are hopping on planes and crossing the ocean and singing a dress rehearsal and then flying back to the Met to sing something there 2 days later. And just that sheer physical taking care of yourself so that you can sing as beautifully as possible is a real challenge.
Oh, I can imagine it must
be a challenge.
And you think singers need to have an education in anatomy and acoustics and really get to know where their voice is coming from physically, right?
I mean, yes.
You mentioned that in something I read.
I feel like it's a spectrum, that there's certainly always a magical part. And the voice just sort of lines up and, oh, it's falling out of my mouth and I'm just in my heart and it's singing through me. And until the last 40 years now, I guess, when voice science came on, it was very mystical. And every voice teacher, because they had a unique instrument, had a unique way that they would talk about singing to their students. So then it's like, well, I know the way, the truth, and the light, and this other voice teacher and that other voice teacher don't know anything because they're not using the words that I'm using. So it was pretty confusing.
I'll
for
bet.
People. You know, very difficult. You had to find somebody you could trust and work with them. Now that we have so much science to tell us that really all these different things, anatomy, acoustics, as you mentioned, and all these different
breathing,
can be learned as a mechanical thing.
So there are definitives now, right? Everybody yes. isn't just flailing it's, around
yeah,
guessing.
Yeah, there's still a lot of, we have more research to do always, but we know some basic things like the Bernoulli effect, which is the same thing, principle that makes airplanes fly, is what makes your vocal folds come together. So it's like, oh, okay. And you can now give singers a structure and say there's a reason why your tongue has to be in this position and your jaw has to be this open, and that will make an ah vowel. If you change your tongue position, it changes the acoustical shape inside your mouth, and it'll be E or it'll be O. So then you can train physical coordination like you're training an athlete. You do push-ups with the back of the tongue going up and down until you can control the position, and that's going to make a difference between whether you say ooh, oh, or ah.
So it's almost like speech therapy.
In a way.
Traditional
yes.
speech therapy.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Uh-huh. So you're still changing your acoustical tube or your shape in there as you were. Sometimes I call it the sound panels. You move the sound panels around.
Uh-huh. God, that's really interesting. I mean, speech is interesting to me anyway. So one learns all of this about their voice, but you can't teach artistry, can you? Or can you?
Ha-ha. You can unveil artistry.
Okay.
And everyone has a heart and has feelings. And everyone can express that with their voice.
And so what do you tell people who are young people trying to have great careers? To trust themselves, to not be afraid to show emotion? How do you explain it?
Yeah, it's actually quite tricky because the American culture is not really very into expressing emotion.
Yeah.
These days, you know, we're very afraid of it. People, if you start to cry, people come and hand you Kleenex and, oh, feel better, cheer up, blah, blah,
blah. Go see your therapist.
Go see your therapist. Don't make me deal with this. Whatever. So to learn that it's A-okay to have those big feelings and to express them is quite a process sometimes for people. And I do keep Kleenex in my office, and we sit and breathe when those big feelings come up, whether it's the music that touches you or a frustration because you can't execute it the way that you want to or whatever. And we have to learn to be really vulnerable in public.
Yeah.
Not an easy process at all. One way I like to do that is to have little cards with different attitudes on it, like cheerful, bitter, angry, giddy, silly, sexy, flirty, you know, different things. And we shuffle the deck. And whatever emotion comes up, that we call it an attitude, which is a little easier to find your way in the door.
Yeah, attitude instead
than
of
emotion.
Yeah.
You have to have an attitude toward your words. For instance, Mary had a little lamb, if I'm happy. Mary had a little lamb. Wow, yes, she did. But if I'm bitter, Mary had a little lamb. Or sarcastic or something like that.
Yeah.
And you have to sing it with whatever attitude comes up, whether it fits your words or not. And they start to learn how to shift between those different states.
So it's acting in some ways,
too. It's acting.
Learning
absolutely.
How to act.
Singing is probably the most liberal of the arts that you can find. Because we're actors, we're musicians, we're historians because we have to go back and look at history, we're literature.
Yeah, I was going to say poetry.
Because of the poetry, and then there's all the science side of it, anatomy and physiology, there's physical training. It just goes on and on and on.
Yeah,
they all come together.
That's amazing. And nobody would have thought of that. They hear somebody sing, you think, oh, you know,
right.
it's part of what we are. We just get up and sing.
Exactly, right. And that's the beauty of it. I like to actually talk about studying singing as though you have a drop-down menu on the computer, so you go from silence to song. But then you can open up the drop-down menu, and maybe today we're going to talk about breathing, or maybe today we're going to talk about language clarity, or we're going to talk about your character or your whatever. And then you close the menu back up, and you just open your mouth and sing.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Carol McAmis. She's a professor at Ithaca College, teaches voice and voice performance. So let's get back to this Feldenkrais method of somatic education. Tell us what it is. Tell us how you got turned onto it and why you're following it.
Sure. Well, let's see. The Feldenkrais method was developed by an Israeli physicist, Moshe Feldenkrais, back in the 1940s. He was a world-class scientist. He helped develop sonar during World War II. He also worked at the Curie Institute prior to that. Also was one of the first settlers to go into Palestine back in the 1930s.
Wow.
So quite a guy. He was one of the first black belts in Europe in judo and injured his knee playing soccer, and it got really bad during World War II, and he was climbing around on slippery boat decks and developing sonar. And the doctors at the time could only offer him a 50-50 chance that surgery would help him. So he decided to go home and think it over. And after 2 years, he had retaught himself how to walk on this injured leg that was supposed to incapacitate him for the rest of his life. Mm. And he basically, what he figured out was how babies learn to walk and talk in the first place. And he figured out how to develop sequences of movements that would allow us to continue that kind of motor learning, neuromotor learning, as adults. The conventional thinking at the time was more that we stopped that kind of learning when we got verbal around three, and that what you had was what you were stuck with. And so I got interested in it because I was always very klutzy when I was a kid. You know, gym was not my favorite class by any means. Give me a piano bench and I'll make my fingers move, but don't ask me to move big muscles. Never mind. So I was sitting in my office one day at IC and thinking, gee, there ought to be something out there someplace for out of shape klutzy singers like me. I really know I need to work with my body and get it in better shape so that I can get to higher levels of singing than I am capable of right now. And I stumbled across a book called A Soprano on Her Head by Eloise Ristad, who was an amazing teacher and one of the first people to really look at things like how are musicians learning what they learn and what does performance anxiety really mean and how can we work with these things. She's a brilliant teacher. And she mentioned Feldenkrais in there and gave a description of a lesson that he had taught. And I read it and I said, little tiny movements lying on the floor and you stand up and your posture and your balance are renovated. I think this is for me.
Wow.
So in the mid-80s, NYU had a conference on mind, body, and performance. It was the first national time that people looked at these kinds of issues with performers' health and the psychological aspects of it. And they had some people there that were doing demonstrations of Feldenkrais work. And I got very excited. I'm going to this conference. It was great. So I went to a lecture. Anat Banyal, who ended up being my teacher in Feldenkrais, was talking about creating a safe environment for people to change and learn in a certain kind of way. And I was fascinated. I'm like, oh, it's got learning attached to it. I'm a teacher. I love this. So we got on the floor and we did a little lesson where you just simply very gently arch your back away from the floor and press it toward the floor. Mm. And then you coordinate your breathing, press your feet different ways. And all of a sudden, I had all this low resonance in my soprano voice. And the backs of my knees were touching the floor, and I didn't know that was anatomically even possible to do. And I thought, well, this is fun. So the next day, I found one of the practitioners and had a hands-on session. There are two different ways you can do the work, through a class or through hands-on work. So she worked a little with my shoulder and my hip going the same direction. I was very jerky about the whole thing. But I stood up, and I was so elegant, and I had never moved so elegantly in my life.
So what is this actually teaching you, though?
It's actually repatterning the nervous system electrical patterns that fire our muscles for how we move.
And it's different than chiropractic, and it's different than Tai Chi.
The focus is really on getting into the deep habitual patterns that we have wired in that we don't even realize. So a simple one is if you interlace your fingers, you'll put one thumb on the top. And then if you change it over, it's going to feel really strange to most people because we habitually will put the same thumb on the top. And we have those. We have to have those kind of patterns to be able to function in our lives. And that's what the baby's job is the first few years of life, is making all of that wiring hook up into neurological patterns. The neurologist will talk to you about Hebbian learning, cells that fire together, wire together in these patterns of big patterns of movement.
And you hear that when people have brain injuries.
Yes,
exactly.
You
can rewire.
Yes, exactly. And so this work can be phenomenally useful for singers and musicians in general because we require such a high level of really fine coordination. And it helps you refine your coordination in ways that you just couldn't imagine that you could get to.
God, that's amazing. I was wondering how it pertained to performers particularly. I read up a little bit about it, and I was wondering how it pertained to that.
Well, that's one of the main things that I started with, was discovering that the fun part about that first experience for me was I came home and started singing again, and my voice was evened out from top to bottom, and I'd been trying to fix that for like 6 months. And I kept telling my teacher, I know what you want. I can't do it. And all of a sudden, the problem was gone simply because my body was moving in a more coordinated way.
Yeah, and are you changing patterns too?
Yes,
putting
absolutely.
Less stress on the pattern that you've been used to for so many
absolutely.
Years?
Absolutely. Absolutely. That's really the process of any skill building, is going from... Michael Merzenich, who's one of the big brain scientists, talk about how our brains are taking in so much information constantly. It's like this, you know, white noise that's going on all the time. Mm-hmm. And the brain's job is to pull out details from here and there and there and wire them together so they become a pattern outside of the background noise. And that's kind of how we build our world and make sense out of our world in general. So the Feldenkrais work is good for anybody. It's great for older people who want to maintain their balance and flexibility well into their, you know, 80s, 90s. Mm-hmm. Some of the people that have been doing this forever, like one of our trainers is almost 90, I think, and you would never know. She's just moves like a dream. Kids that are born with neurological difficulties, cerebral palsy, autism spectrum. My teacher's brilliant with that. She wrote a book called Kids Beyond Limits that's just incredible. Wow. So it goes way beyond just performing to anything.
So does one need to continue to take classes in this, or do you learn certain techniques?
Do you need to keep practicing walking? No, you do it. You know,
So that's the answer.
Could you get better at walking?
Okay.
Always.
But you do, you go and you learn these techniques and you can
yes.
carry them with
yes.
you.
Yes. So the way that my training worked, we went for intensive periods like 10 days, and then we would go away for 2 or 3 months and let your nervous system process it and then come back. In a few more months, take another 2 weeks or something, and then go away for a few months, another 10 days. And we did that for 4 years. And people started to look like they'd found the fountain of youth. It was pretty fun.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff.
How do you deal with performance anxiety? I mean, that's one thing that I know everybody who's ever been in a performer
right.
has to deal with.
Right.
So does this method help with that?
Absolutely.
And how do you, Carol McAmis, as a teacher, help people with that?
Well, one of the important things, especially for people that work with their voices, because we hear differently inside our bodies than the rest of the world hears us through mm-hmm. the air.
Mm-hmm.
We hear through our bones and through the air, so we get a different sound than you would get from my voice just listening through the air.
Uh-huh.
So in the singer world, the conventional wisdom is that you'll never hear yourself the way that everybody else hears you. Therefore, you can never know how you sound. So you have to rely on your teacher and the music critic at the newspaper and this lady in the front row with blue hair to tell you how you're singing and what music you should sing. And that's absolutely not true. We have to learn an inner sound that is, we get feedback from people that that's the way that we sound the best.
Uh-huh.
And that inside your head, it's not always what you thought it was, because sometimes you're entertaining yourself listening to it.
So this helps with anxiety, huh?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you're not really secure about your sound. And a lot of times, if the teacher is giving you feedback, but what you gave them was your best shot, you sang what you thought was ah, but it sounds like out in the room,
uh-huh.
and then you don't know how to change it. So then you start going, oh, I can't trust myself. And that's a lot where a lot of the performance anxiety comes from. You don't trust yourself to know what you're doing, how you're sounding.
Uh-huh.
So that's one place it can come from. And it can also come from well-intentioned people.
We've heard of all those people,
who
yes.
who come up to you after your little piano recital or your little voice recital and go, that was great. You didn't make any mistakes. So then mistakes, you know, and being an acrobat that doesn't fall off of the tightrope becomes a really important part of performing well, that we're not allowing children enough opportunity to mess around and make mistakes.
Yeah, yeah. We do expect perfection.
Try things out, you know, and it seems it's more difficult, I think, you know, when you've got an instrument, you start putting the child's arm in the correct position so they won't injure themselves later in life on the violin, and then they get afraid to try anything else. So one of the things that's lovely about the Feldenkrais movement work is that it encourages lots of non-habitual things, or even sometimes we think of them as intentional mistakes. And learning to do the mistake on purpose is a step that's often left out in skill training, in music training, but also athletics too, I think, sometimes. But until you can do it wrong and know what you did to make it be wrong, you can't permanently change it. And that's a huge place that stage fright will come from.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. You stop trusting yourself after right. that. Now, I want to talk to you about your singing and sure. your career. What is it like for you to perform? Do you still love it? Do you do it often?
I love it. I haven't been doing so much lately because I've gotten so involved with the Feldenkrais work and just keeping all of that stuff going. I'm really quite fascinated in how the voice heals us and lots of different things like that. But I've done a lot of performing in my life and still love it when I get a chance to really get in shape and do it. It's a lot of fun. I think my background, being an instrumentalist before I was a singer, has led me in kind of interesting and quirky directions in terms of what I want to put together as a performer. My latest thing that I've really been enjoying, I did a lot of opera when I was younger, and singing oratorio and all the classical things like that, which I adore. It's beautiful music. And lately, though, I've gotten interested in improv singing and have done a lot of work with Bobby McFerrin and going to workshops that he does called Circle Singing every year. And that's been a lot of fun and opened my classical. I need the score in front of me to see all the little black spots. It's opened the doors up to just simply listening to the music that's inside my heart and bringing it out.
And you can make mistakes.
And you can make mistakes. It's wonderful. And make the mistake work and be the perfect thing, you know.
So you continue learning even though you're an established professor, educator.
Absolutely. Right now I'm really working hard on understanding all the new brain research that's coming out, because that's really going to change, I think, a lot how we teach singing and how we approach what this instrument is. Because I call it an imaginary instrument, because really what you think is what's going to come out, and if you think you're not going to sound good, a lot of times it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah, and that's the way with any creative arts.
Exactly.
You know, you've got to believe in what you're
exactly.
doing and allow yourself to be human
right.
while you're doing it.
So this whole relatively new in the last 20 years idea of neuroplasticity, that the brain keeps changing itself throughout life, is something that actually that Feldenkrais built into the movement lessons back in the 1940s. He intuited his way into what science is showing us now, for sure.
Wow, that's very exciting. Fascinating. Well, Kara McAmis, we're almost out of time. Thank you so much for joining us. Do you have any contact information that people can get in touch with you?
Yes. If you go to ithaca.edu on the web, we have faculty websites there. And my name is Carol McAmis, McAmis. And you can email me at mcamis.ithaca.edu.
Great. Well, Carol McAmis, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And we are a sponsored project of the New York Foundation for the Arts. Tax-deductible donations are welcome at artspire.org. That's artspire.org. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. I'm Tish Perlman. We'll be back next week.